Period issue for all women.
Hello, hello, and welcome to this week's Sunday Chops. It's Mickey this week with an interview I am properly excited about. I'm lucky to talk to all sorts of brilliant women doing all sorts of brilliant things. And so I'd hand on heart say it's very tricky to pick a favourite chat. And yet, whenever I catch up with journalist Jenny Kleeman, my mind is genuinely blown. Since her debut non-fiction, Sex, Robots and Vegan Meat, which also marked the first time I chatted to Jenny on the podcast, I have followed her work closely. Her latest book, The Price of Life, investigates the prices on our heads and who decides them, and is another total banger that will make you laugh, make you gasp, and potentially make you be a little bit sick in your own mouth. But above all this, it will make you think. Are cold calculations the way to measure a life? I mean, I don't think so. But what is the measure then? And is maths ever useful here? For The Price of Life, Jenny has met a hitman, people who have faked their own death, modern-day slaves, the makers of F-35 fighter jets, scientists, effective altruists, parents whose children have died in terrorist attacks, kidnap victims, and for her frankly wild final chapter, an American funeral parlour owner and body broker, although he really, really does not like that term. I could have talked about that chapter for hours, like hours. In fact, I'm probably going to read it again once I'm done here. I do always joke that Jenny's reporting is nightmare fuel, but she also writes with a lot of hope and a great deal of faith in humanity. I cannot recommend The Price of Life more, and it's available now from all good bookshops. The stuff that Jenny uncovers and articulates is always incredible, and in this case, likely to play havoc with my life insurance premiums in a good way. Up the women. On that note, if you like listening to us interviewing brilliant women like Jenny, and you have a few quid to spare each month, we would be mighty grateful if you joined our Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/standardissue. For just a quid a month, you get our podcast with zero ads. And we have got some exciting new membership additions in the works, so please keep an ear out for those. We do, however, know that times are tight, so you can help us keep going for no cash at all by just telling people to give us a go. Send them your favourite interview to listen to. Spread the Standard Issue joy. Hello, I'm joined on the Zoom by journalist, broadcaster, documentary maker, author, and officially one of my favourite people to interview, Jenny Kleeman. Jenny, hello.
Hello, what an introduction. Thank you.
Welcome back. Third time's the charm.
I love it here. I'm feeling very comfortable.
Oh, we love having you. I say that, but in past chats, you and I have talked about sex robots and what they mean for women's rights. The not very vegan origins of vegan meat, the unwanted surprises people are getting thanks to the popularity of home DNA test kits. And each time I have immersed myself in your investigative reporting, I've emerged wide-eyed with much more knowledge, a little less faith in humanity, and new nightmare fuel. So my first question is, how do you sleep at night, woman?
Well, at the moment, I don't sleep very well because I've got a book coming out and I have lots of weird anxiety dreams about that. But no, generally, I sleep quite well because I think I see the worst and the best of humanity in my work. I hope I would convince you. You know, there's some pretty dark stuff, but sometimes how people respond to it can be quite remarkable and life-affirming, I hope.
Yes. No, that is true. That is true. I saw the New Statesman have described you as Louis Theroux channeling Margaret Atwood, but they did miss out the part where you remind me quite a lot of Crime Watch.
With a little bit of Crime Watch thrown in, yes.
So your new book, The Price of Life, In Search of What We're Worth and Who Decides, is your exploration into who puts a price on our heads. It is both fascinating and brutal, as I have come to expect from you. It made me laugh, it made me gasp, and it made me want to bleach my newly informed mind quite a few times. So Kleeman, you've done it again. What made you want to write this book?
There were many things. I mean, first of all, I am not a numbers person and I kind of bristle at the idea that we're all now measured in terms of numbers, in terms of, likes and retweets and book sales and all of these metrics that make us very easy to compare with each other. But actually, the quality of who we are and what we are gets lost in all of that. And it's sort of antithetical to the work that I do, which is about going and meeting people and talking to them and getting a real sense of what they're like rather than reducing them to metrics. But I had quite an interesting experience in the pandemic, in that just before the pandemic, I did some reporting where I interviewed these Silicon Valley philanthropists on how they give their money away. And I kind of went into those scenarios with a very arched eyebrow of like, oh my God, look at these weirdos who are kind of calculating the cheapest lives to save. How many lives can they save for a dollar? What's the biggest bang for your philanthropic buck? Isn't this grotesque? And then the pandemic came along and all of a sudden governments were calculating, you know, how much are we prepared to spend to save lives? How much are we prepared for the economy to suffer in order that people don't die? And also these philanthropists that I'd been speaking to, one of the things that they had been giving money to try and prevent was pandemics. And in November 2019, when I went over to California to interview them, I was thinking, these guys are mad. It's like Bond villain stuff. They're obsessed with sci-fi, pandemics, AI. This is hilarious. And then I realized that they were kind of right. I wanted to look at what we lose and what we gain when we are prepared to put numbers on people, on prices on lives. And so I did a bit of searching and I thought about all the different circumstances in which this happens. And I realized that it happens all the time, very quietly, without us noticing. Prices are put on our lives. And it was a very interesting exercise. As somebody who's not that into numbers, it was a really interesting journey to go on.
So as well as those effective altruists that you were talking about in Silicon Valley, which it is crazy. It's like the trolley problem, massive, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you've spoken to a hitman, people who have faked their own death, modern day slaves, the makers of F-35s, scientists. How did you decide who could give you answers to this huge question?
I broke it down into all the different scenarios where prices are put on lives. And I tried to find the person who is behind the price. And, you know, when you write a book, you write a book proposal first. And I'd written all this stuff in the book proposal, like, I will go in and ask a hitman how they come up with their prices, or, you know, all of these different kind of promises I'd made. And then I had to write the book and I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to actually have to find these people. So quite often it was just simply working out who is at the beginning and who is at the end of the equation, because I wanted this to be a book about human stories, human experience, and what's it like to be the mother of a murdered child where a price has been put on your child's murder? What is it like to lose somebody in a terrorist attack and discover that the price put on your loved one's life is so much lower than the price put on someone else's life who was killed by the same people in the same attack but just happened to be killed in a different way? So it came from just basically making a really big list of the various and wide-ranging ways in which prices are put on human lives, and then thinking who sets the price and who is the person feeling the effect.
I don't think there's any number in there, and they range from £200 to $400 billion that isn't shocking when you explain why that number exists. Each chapter is a number, a price on someone's head, that ranges from $400 to $400 billion. Can you explain a bit about the structure of the book, please?
Yes. So the book begins with the price of taking a life. So there I look at how hitmen decide what to charge, what a murder costs society, and how much the most expensive weapon in the world costs. Then there's the price of a life lost. So there's a price of insurance. This is where I talk about people who fake their own death, which apparently happens all the time.
Yeah.
People who try and get life insurance by faking their own death.
You obviously bring up Canoe Man, which I think is one that everyone will relate to. And you're like, his wasn't even very exciting. He didn't even try very hard.
His was pretty mundane, really. I got deep into the world of people who fake their own death, which was really, really quite hilarious, and tracked down what I found a man called John, whose job it is to find people who claim to be dead. And that was fun. And then there is the price of saving a life, where I look at philanthropy and how much the NHS will spend to save your life, and also how much it costs for our lives to be saved from COVID. And there's a bit about creating life, which is about biological parenthood, IVF. There's a bit about the price of a human being, because slaves and people kidnapped for ransom are sold for a price. And yeah, the end of it is the price of a human body. How much is your cadaver worth?
It's interesting. There are some photos in there of you as well in various places when you're doing your reporting. And you look so much more comfortable sat next to a hitman than you do in the factory that makes the F-35 bombers.
Yes, it's really funny. So these pictures, whenever I'm reporting anything for print, I take pictures because it helps when I'm describing the scene. Because my background is in documentary making and I learned to be a journalist whilst having a camera there. So I'm always kind of thinking in terms of scenes. And so I take pictures. And my editor said, oh, do you have any pictures we can use for the book? And this was after I had written it. So I wasn't really expecting any of these pictures to go in, which is why they're a bit rough around the edges and there isn't one per chapter. But yeah, when I was having dinner with the hitman wanted a selfie with me. So
of course,
there's a selfie. And I'd had a dirty martini at the time, so I had that coursing through my veins, and so I'm smiling a bit more. But yeah, it was very weird having my picture taken in the factory where these killing machines are made, because it was just completely overwhelming, huge factory of incredibly expensive killing machines. And I just didn't really know what to make of it. And there were so many restrictions on what I could and couldn't do. There was one place where they said they could take my picture and I needed a photograph of the factory. So I was very happy to pose for this picture so that when I came home, I could then describe what I was seeing, because it was so overwhelming being in there. I had this photograph taken of me by their official photographer so that I could describe what was in the background. Yeah, I'm kind of grinning like a loon in that picture.
It's really interesting, and these kind of juxtapositions happen a lot in the book. But as we're talking about the hitman and the F-35's factory, it felt like reading about them that your gangster, your reformed gangster, had more respect for individual, personal, human life than the people who were making these machines that can kill so many individuals. And I wondered whether you thought that was because he had to be really up close and personal with people. And obviously, it's very removed when you're making these bombers.
I think that's really right. I mean, he could see the lives that he was taking. And whilst he said that at the time he was doing it, he didn't feel anything, he says that now there's a reckoning and he has, you know, he thinks about them all the time. Yeah, the people who, Lockheed Martin, who make the F-35 fighter jet, were just completely removed from what the F-35 did and wouldn't really, they couldn't tell me where it had been deployed. They wouldn't tell me where it had been deployed. Nobody could tell me how many lives it had taken. And they also couldn't tell me how much it cost, which was quite ridiculous because I'd flown all the way over to Texas from the UK. And they could give me all of these numbers about how many jobs it created and the capacity of this machine, but they wouldn't tell me how much it costs, which was quite ridiculous. I did find out in the end. But yeah, it was all very much this kind of, you know, the military industrial complex there, and it all about, you know, it being an industry that was very important and symbolic and powerful in terms of defense as a deterrent. But they wouldn't actually really go into detail about the fact that this, you know, was capable of taking out enormous numbers of lives very quickly if it was used in that way.
Yeah, which, you know, we're seeing it being used in that way.
Yes.
But yeah, they are very much stressing how many lives it will save as a deterrent, which seems a very wonky way to talk about your military equipment.
Yes, and also, you know, it's a lot of money to spend. I mean, it's the $400 billion is how much has been spent on these planes. We in the UK, I think, have spent something like $40 or $50 billion on some of these planes. And whether or not that has made us safer, I think, is a point to debate, really.
Oh, I think this is going to be held up as an example of the sunk cost fallacy at some
point.
Well,
exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah, definitely.
Exactly. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And you think, how would you choose to spend $40 billion if you had it, to spend it on this country? And the fact that we've spent it on these machines, I mean, yeah, it's created jobs in this country, but, you know, there are also other ways of creating jobs.
I totally agree with you. Now, that is one example where it was very specifically difficult to find a figure because they were being shady about it.
Yes.
For various reasons. But I wondered, across the book, how hard was it to get the figures to get those averages?
It's a really good question. Sometimes it was really easy. Sometimes the figures are out there, like for the NHS, the £20,000 to £30,000 per quality adjusted life year. That's kind of well known. It's well established. It's also plucked out of nowhere, as I discovered, which was a bit frightening.
God. Yeah, totally frightening.
Yeah, the NHS has decided how much it will spend to save your life on, you know, basically they just picked a figure out.
Just lick their
nowhere.
Finger and put it in the air.
Yes, exactly. That was quite amazing. So some of the figures are out there. Some of the figures are in kind of civil servants' reports that you search around on the internet for. It's not hard to find. Others, like the cost of a hitman, there were academics who'd done studies, but those studies are always, you know, slightly dodgy because, particularly with the cost of a hitman, you're talking about unsuccessful hitmen, hitmen who've been caught.
Really bad at their job.
They're bad at their job, so we know how much they charge. So generally, it wasn't that hard to find the figures, except for how much the F-35 cost. That took quite a lot of doing. And also the average cost of a ransom. It was so interesting investigating the world of kidnap and ransom, because the people who do have those figures won't give them to you, because as soon as those figures are out there, then you're giving kidnappers benchmarks, basically, and they don't want to put anything into the public domain that will help kidnappers. So I have a figure there, but probably the real price is probably quite a bit higher.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question, and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much. That does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, isn't it? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard. It's such a fascinating topic, and I think it's something that we do think about and we do see a lot without actually doing the maths. So, yeah. You know, watching films and TV programs, someone's family is killed or, you know, fridged in a film plot, and we see that person enact revenge, and we're maybe on their side and they're taking out loads of other lives. Or a gangster takes out a whole load of people. I mean, a massive Sopranos fan here. I've watched it 8 times. You know, it just... So you kind of see it and we're a little bit numb to it because it's telly. And the value of people's lives are relative to the people who care about them, right? And yeah. We're currently seeing this writ large on a horrific wider theatre in the world. But an actual fiscal price seems sort of unthinkable. And it's one of those questions that, because obviously since reading your book, I've been really thinking about that. And it feels like it's one of those questions that if needs be, we can sort of be objective about it until it's really fucking subjective. Then it'll go out the window, be that people who you love or, you know, money that someone loves.
One of the really interesting things I learned, well, there were two really interesting things I learned from doing the reporting for this book. One is we're putting prices on lives all the time, because the minute that you say that any kind of potentially life-saving intervention is too expensive, it could be a drug. It could be having hard shoulders instead of motorways. It could be, I say this in the book, it could be putting extra lifeboats on the Titanic. As soon as you decide, oh, we're not going to do that because it's too expensive, you have revealed the limits of what you are prepared to pay to save a life. So you've put a price on human life. But the other thing that I learned is that if you are under the illusion, and it's an illusion that life is priceless, that you can't put a cap on the price of life, what you end up doing is creating an outcome that you never would have wanted to create. So during COVID, the mayor of New York and also Rishi Sunak, the same mantra over and over again, we will do whatever it takes. Life is priceless. We will do whatever it takes to save lives. And what that meant in real terms is the amount that the UK government spent to save your and my life from COVID is 6 times more than the NHS will spend to save our lives from anything else. And you know, I don't think that lockdown was a bad idea. I'm not anti-vax, but it is an interesting fact there that we were prepared to spend all of this money saving ourselves from one disease, which we wouldn't spend otherwise. Uh-huh. So, you have to be realistic about things, and you have to think about, okay, where is my limit? We are in a world of finite resources. Where is the limit? Because as soon as you say there isn't a limit, you end up skewing things in a way that you perhaps would never have planned to.
It's such a good and very recent example, isn't it? But like, you speak to a very bold scientist who makes an incredible case for, yeah, we should have let more old people die. And you're like, oh, objectively, that sounds terrible. But also, what about my old people? No, thank you. My vulnerable people? No, thank you. And that's where we were. Most of us were during the pandemic.
Yes. And I think given the choice, most of us would do it again.
Yeah, totally.
Even though we're all still, I personally, I'm still really getting over what happened in lockdown. Not so much COVID, but the fact that we had our liberty taken away for so long. But we would do it again. And the reason why we followed the rules was because we don't want to live in a world where we could be killing our neighbour or killing a relative. Even if we weren't in possession of the facts, we did all of this stuff because we couldn't live with ourselves if we hadn't done it. Mm. So it wasn't about a kind of calculation of maximising health or maximising utility or any of these things which health economists or people who crunch the numbers think of. There is actually a sort of a subjective thing which is actually more important, which is, could you live with yourself if you took the risk, even if the numbers show that risk might have been worth taking?
Such a good point. And so what I wanted to ask as well is, where did you find the coldest calculations?
It was the effective altruists. It's the Silicon Valley philanthropists who were prepared to calculate not just who's got the cheapest life to save, which is children in Africa. It's very cost effective pouring your money into that, which meant it led to a mindset where, I don't know if you've been to San Francisco or the Bay Area, but across America, in American cities, there is such a crisis of homelessness, which is so shocking when you see it. You know, people in mental health crisis, sleeping on the streets, living in tents. And these are billionaires who will literally step over these people to go to their offices, the offices of their philanthropic foundations, and wire all this money to Africa because you can save more brute lives that way. And perhaps the most shocking thing was I discovered that some of the researchers working for these foundations were even prepared to calculate, when is the worst time in a person's life for them to die? Is it worse if a newborn dies or if a mother of young children dies? And they calculated that the worst time to die is when you're 8 years old, because then you have the greatest number of years potentially ahead of you that will be lost. And you've also made the greatest number of meaningful connections with other people in your community because you've been around for 8 years. You're not just a newborn. And I sort of read this and I thought, I don't want to meet people who are prepared to use logic this cold. It's really, really shocking. But then, as I said, this was before the pandemic. And I realized that there is benefit in some people thinking this way. It's just what's shocking is the people thinking this way are able to direct the money of some of the richest people in the world. And that's quite incredible that there's just so much money being spent according to these principles.
Yeah. Did you get the notion that if it was subjected to them, it would shift?
Maybe. I mean, I think a lot of these philanthropists would give their money away according to principles that aren't in line with effective altruism, but they wouldn't class that as philanthropy. They would say that's like a hobby or that's something that they're doing to enrich their own experience. That's not proper philanthropy. It's not proper giving. So they might, for example, give money to Wikipedia because they like the idea of Wikipedia, but they wouldn't think of that as giving to charity. They would put it in some other kind of category in their brain. But it's, you know, it's more than just the rational calculation. It's the idea that giving money to a cancer charity because your mother died of cancer, that is unevolved as an idea, that is kind of primitive. That's what this thinking is.
I like being primitive, though.
Yeah. Well, it's the whole point of, why do you give money to charity? Do you give it to save the maximum brute number of lives? Or do you give it because you want to create a certain world for everybody to live in? And I fall into the latter camp. And I think charity is about community. And it's about the world that you live in and that you want to live in. It's not just about numbers on a spreadsheet where you can kind of gamify and say, oh, look, I saved X number of lives, which is more than you did because you gave to the wrong charity, you know.
Totally. I did philosophy as part of my university degree. I mean, obviously, that was many decades ago. So any actual philosophers out there, forgive me if I'm a bit sketchy on the details now. It all seems very Kantian, and I always found him very, very cold. Like, his theory was, if you get any pleasure or take any kind of benefit yourself from what you're doing, it's not altruistic.
Yes. And it's also pure utilitarianism, a lot of this, which involves you to turn yourself into a computational machine for maximizing benefit to humanity. And it just depends what you think benefit is. If you can reduce it down to a number and it just becomes maximum number of lives saved per dollar, then that's one thing. But I don't think that's what benefit is necessarily. It is also about enriching the world for yourself and others. That's okay. You know, that's okay.
Yeah. Jenny, are you ever going to stop tackling just really easy questions?
I like these weird questions. I like these weird ethical questions through which we all, who are not at the extremes, learn something in the middle. And I love going and talking to these people. They really make you think. They make you frame why you believe what you believe in a much sharper way than if you weren't meeting people at the extremes, I think.
I'm going to talk about someone you met, a person at the extreme. I could do a whole separate podcast on that final chapter, which is called $5,000 excluding shipping, because Garland Treves, a funeral parlour owner and body broker, sorry, Garland, that's what you are, is a documentary in the making.
He totally is. He totally is. So Garland Treves sells dead bodies to medical researchers and to biomedical device companies, so companies that make like hip replacements or surgeons who might want to practice doing nose jobs. He sells cadavers. And this is interesting for many reasons, but one of the reasons is in the UK, this is actually a separate thing, a reporting project that I've been doing for about 4 years now. I've been doing a lot about people who donate their bodies to medical research and the study of anatomy. And in the UK, you can't buy dead bodies. Sure. We rely on people to donate them, but not enough people are donating them. And when there aren't enough, we buy them from the US, where, of course, in the land of the free, you are able to buy a cadaver if you want to.
Oh, capitalism.
Yes, exactly. Beautiful capitalism. So you can't sell your own body or the body of your relative. But if you donate it to one of these commercial companies, they will pay for the cremation, so you don't have to worry about that. And they will sell it. They will dismember your body generally and sell it piece by piece.
What are they cremating then?
They're cremating what's left
over. The leftovers. Awesome. Yes. Lovely. Thank you.
Sometimes there's not very much.
Give me the bleach for my brain again, Jenny. Thank you.
I know far too much about all of this. So Garland is not a big player. He is based in Arizona, which is like the center of the global tissue banking industry. He would call it tissue banking, not body broking.
Sure.
He said to me right at the beginning of our conversation, I'll talk to you, but don't call me a body broker. If you call me a body broker, I'll call you a prostitute.
What an opener.
I said, okay. But that's kind of what he's like. He's a big, straight talking guy.
Are you still in touch?
Well, I was in touch with him a week or so ago to tell him that the book was coming out. And also I've written something about the study of anatomy using cadavers. And I've quoted from him, not the craziest parts from him, but I've written something for the Sunday Times magazine, which is putting him in it. Not the bit where he says, I'm going to call you a prostitute, because I'm not very Sunday Times magazine kind of line. I'm glad you're giving it to us, though.
I'm pleased with
that. Yeah. I know you guys. I've only been in touch with him then, but yeah, he's quite a character.
Oh my God. That chapter took me so long to read because I had to read it like three times. I kept going, what is that sentence? What? No. And then I'd have to go and read it out loud to my husband and get his reaction. Absolutely phenomenal stuff, listeners. You really got to read it. I'm going to ask you a question you ask in the book. Are we letting ourselves down by expecting numbers to give us answers to the toughest moral questions?
Well, I would say yes, but I'm biased because I'm not a numbers person. My bread and butter is traveling to see people, sitting and talking to them for hours and listening very closely to what they say. And I worry, particularly in this kind of, you know, in the world of the AI revolution that we're living in now, where everything is being reduced to tiny increments of data, which are particularly numbers, that we are losing the texture of things. And when we're looking at what we value, that value is being turned into a number rather than a set of ethical principles. So I do think so. But as I said, I'm biased. And many of the people I spoke to in the book would say I am not sufficiently evolved. That I'm
primitive,
you know,
Jenny. So
yeah, I'm primitive. I'm Newtonian physics in a world of Einstein, whatever it is. I you know, I have real faith in human beings, and I think we have quite good intuitive judgments about what matters. The skill is to be able to articulate why our gut is telling us what it's telling us. And we need to get better at probing that rather than just relying on the numbers. But I did find studying the price of life really interesting. It's a really interesting tool. It's a really interesting tool for revealing injustices. It's a really interesting tool for revealing if we are saying something with our actions that we don't mean to say, i.e. COVID matters six times more than cancer, or this person killed in a terrorist attack is worth so much more because they were killed by a car rather than stabbed by the terrorists. I mean, that is an incredibly useful thing to be able to reveal. But we have to just think of it as a tool and not as a kind of answer to things. And that's how we've got to look at numbers. We shouldn't be beguiled by their simplicity. We should see if they're revealing something interesting. But we have to have lots of different things in our toolkit and not just numbers.
Do you have sort of more sympathy with some of those number crunchers, though, now?
Yes, I do. You know, I think, for example, the health economist who worked for the NHS, I interviewed someone who was really into her job and spoke like she was reading from an Excel spreadsheet. You know, you need people like that. You need people who are really into spreadsheets and data if you are trying to allocate resources in a world of finite resources. You need people like that. And that's why there's room for a whole different set of approaches when you're looking at all of this. So I do have more sympathy for people who are prepared to crunch the numbers in a way that I didn't at the beginning. Like I said, I went into this like, oh my God, look at these Silicon Valley computer people who are prepared to ask these terrible questions. And I was wrong to go in with that approach. And, you know, I'm glad to have learned that I was wrong because I see the benefit of it. But the whole point is you need to be open to a whole different raft of approaches when you're asking these difficult ethical questions. So there is no one correct way, I would say.
Yeah, they still sound like quite terrible people to me. But, you know, I haven't met them, so I can say that.
They were really, really clever. That was a quite scary thing. And they knew it. I mean, this was the whole thing. These are all people who come from elite universities. They are young tech people in hoodies, men from elite universities who are used to being the cleverest person in the room and are therefore really convinced that they're right and really convinced that everyone else will catch up one day. And the fact that they, or the people who give them money to donate to charity, have been incredibly successful in business is empirical evidence of their good judgment. And, you know, the rest of us will eventually catch up. So that was really intimidating. It was very intimidating going to interview people who are very clever and know that they're very clever. You know, I had to really, really think on my feet.
That's how I feel when I interview you, Jenny, to be
fair. Oh, Mickey, don't say
that. It's the Clemen. Among the discoveries, and I'm back in that final chapter again, Jenny, I may never leave. But the discoveries that they'd found a torso that someone had decapitated and sewn a slightly smaller head onto.
Yes.
It's so fucking weird. So
yes.
This is in your book and, oh, joyous in its own macabre way. But what was your wildest discovery? What blew your mind in your research?
Oh, gosh. There was so much that blew my mind in my research. Some of it is really sad and some of it is really disturbing. It was more at the end of it when I was comparing all the numbers that I put together and discovering that, like, there's a kind of £14,000 mark, which is the general cost of the price of life. And it's about the same. Hiring a hitman, the average hitman is about £15,000. And the cost of creating a life through IVF is like £13,500. So it costs the same to make a life as to take it out, basically.
Yeah.
That was quite extraordinary. And also just getting a sense of my own worth, or how women are actually worth a lot more than men because we're more valuable as slaves. You know, we can be trafficked, and our ovaries and wombs and longer hair make our bodies more valuable. That was really quite something. Although we are less likely to value ourselves when it comes to putting a price on our own lives in life insurance. So with life insurance, you come up with your own number of how much you think you need to be insured. And women tend to value themselves consistently as worth 2/3 less than men for some reason.
I find this a very powerful message for International Women's Day, which is when Jenny and I are chatting.
Yeah.
It's mixed messages from women there. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, well, it's that we don't value ourselves enough, and yet we are worth a lot to society, perhaps for really dark reasons. But, you know, we are much less willing to say, you know, I am worth the same amount of money as a man. And that's because I think women have babies and take time off work to do that. And because we live in a society that values human beings purely in terms of their income, we think, oh, we're not worth that much when we're insuring our lives. But surely if you have taken time off to have a family, then you're kind of worth even more, really, because your family will really suffer from the loss of you if you die. So yes, it really made me think about that, how we value ourselves as well as how we value each other.
The Price of Life, In Search of What We're Worth and Who Decides, is published by Picador on March the 14th. Are you still shockable, Jenny?
Yes, I am still shockable. I was in America over the weekend doing some reporting for some pieces I'm going to write for The Guardian, and something really shocking happened during one of the interviews, which I can't tell you about right now, but something really shocking happened in real time. And, you know, there's always stuff that will shock you out there. But it is, as I said, it's in those extremes that it makes you articulate what you believe when you're not at the extremes and why. And you have to kind of keep looking for that.
Yeah. I find it comforting that you're still, you know, able to be shocked by stuff. And also really comforting that you said earlier on that you still have a lot of faith left in humanity. Because wowzers.
Yeah. Like, well, you learn about incredible altruistic things that people do, incredible things that people will do for other people, the amazing ideas that people will have to save people, and the kind of power of human determination when you look at these extremes as well. So yeah, I have infinite faith in humanity.
And I don't want to argue with you, Jenny, but I do want to remind you that someone took a human torso and they sewed on a smaller head.
Yes, and we don't know why. And also, that's not illegal in America. That's all totally fine.
Land of the free.
Exactly.
As well as listening to you here, is there anything else exciting that people should keep an eye out?
Well, I've got quite a few pieces coming out in The Guardian. You were asking about things that shock me. I have a piece coming out on Saturday, the 16th of March, about a liver surgeon, big transplant surgeon, big hero, saved lots of lives. He gave someone a liver transplant and it failed. A week later, one of his colleagues gave this woman another liver transplant. He opened up a patient to do the transplant and he saw burnt on this woman's liver the initials SB,
oh,
the initials of Simon Bramall, the first surgeon's initials. And so he was discovered to have been burning his initials onto his patients when he gave them liver transplants. So he's given me this interview because he now writes books. It took 9 years for him to be struck off. He was still a surgeon for 9 years after all of this was discovered. He's finally been struck off and he's now writing self-published medical thrillers, including his latest book, which is about a celebrated liver surgeon who is caught burning his initials into his patient's livers.
Where did he get the idea?
Indeed. So I've written this piece about surgeons and the trust we give to surgeons and what happens when we're asleep.
Again, I don't want to question your life choices, Jenny, but that faith in humanity, is it really not rock solid?
Yeah, maybe I'm going to have to look at that again.
So you are out and about promoting the book. Where can people find out where they can see you?
I've got a website, jennyclieman.com. If you go to jennyclieman.com/events, you will see I am traveling up and down the country giving talks about the book. I would love to see Standard Issue listeners there. So come along and say hi.
I mean, a fascinating nightmare, as always. Thank you so much for chatting with me, Jenny.
Thank you for having me.
Standard Issue, for all women.